This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome to the world of Forbes, Barron's, and Fortune magazines. This is brought to you by the good folks at Mind's Eye Organization. My name is Greg Conroy. So let's get down to business. Beginning with Forbes magazine, Stundis Glass and Bezos, the S is a dollar sign, blend cannabis and Latino culture. This was written by A.J. Harrington. High-end smoking accessories manufacturer Stunden Glass is giving a nod to Latino cannabis culture with a new special edition gravity infuser through a collaboration with Los Angeles-based Bezos. That's spelled B-E-$OS. Featuring a design inspired by traditional patterns deeply tied to Mexican craftsmanship known as Talavera, the new device is now available on the Bezos and Stunden Glass websites and at select retail partners. Stunden Glass is known worldwide for its luxury quality gravity infusers, commonly referred to as gravity bongs. The brand's new collaboration is its first with Bezos, a Latin cannabis lifestyle, quote, brand rooted in culture, community, and identity, close quote. Quote, from the moment we connected with the Bezos team, there was a real energy there, a hunger, a creativity, and a vision that felt very familiar to me. If you've been in this space long enough, you recognize that spark when you see it, and Bezos has it, close quote. Chris Folkert, CEO at Stunden Glass, said in a statement about the launch, quote, what really got me excited about this collaboration is what it represents culturally. The Talavera-inspired design brings everything back to the art, the history, and the roots behind it. It's not just about putting out another product. It's about creating something that carries meaning, something that people can connect with on a deeper level. Close quote. Bezos founder Christian Poo launched the brand with a line of pre-rolls and all-in-one cannabis vaporizers in 2025. With a line of products inspired by Latino culture, including Agua Fresca-inspired pre-rolls and fruit-forward vape profiles, the brand is now available throughout Northern and Southern California. In an online interview, Poo says that the collaboration with Stunden Glass is more significant than slapping the Bezos logo on a popular device. Instead, the two brands aim to create a piece of useful art that pairs Bezos' South Central cultural lens with Stunden Glass's famous engineering. Quote, from the beginning, I pitched to them that this isn't about money, close quote, he explains. Quote, this was never a profit-driven decision because, in fact, we're losing money, like in the six figures for this project, just so we can bring to life this functional piece of art, just so I can push art out into the world for those few that can really appreciate it. After connecting with Stunden Glass leadership at Spanibus, Europe's premier cannabis culture festival, Poo reached out to Folkerts to explore a potential partnership. Quote, as soon as I met the founder, Chris, it was like that. Just a spark happened and we got along. We met over lunch and yeah, like we've been getting to know each other very well, close quote, he explains. Quote, he's someone I can honestly call a big brother now, but since the very beginning, I wanted to just create this piece of art with me and my team, also not just for the art itself, but kind of as a milestone for us in our team, because we get 10% closer at the end of every project we do. Like we get 10% closer into understanding who we are, how we're wired, what the brand is, close quote. Continuing in Forbes, SEC reverses day trading rule in Boone for retail brokers. This is by Brandon Kokoden of the Forbes staff. The SEC is unwinding a rule born from the wreckage of the dot-com crash. On Tuesday, regulators approved a change that will get rid of the so-called pattern day trader rule, a two-decade-old requirement that forced active margin traders to keep at least $25,000 in their brokerage account if they wanted to make frequent trades. The rule came out of the early 2000s when regulators worried that small investors were taking excessive risks by buying and selling stocks with borrowed money. Under the old rule, anyone who made four or more day trades in five business days was labeled, quote, a pattern day trader, close quote. Once that happened, the trader had to keep at least $25,000 in the account at all times. Critics said the rule never made much sense. They argued it acted more like a wealth test than a safety measure. A person with $24,000 could be blocked from making trades, while someone with $25,001 could keep going. Regulators also noted that the rule was written for a different era, before zero-commission trading apps, real-time data, and easy access to market research. The change could be good news for retail investors who want more flexibility. It could also be a win for brokerage firms like Robinhood and Webull that have courted novice investors with lower balances. They are likely to see more trading activity. Critics say the old rule existed for a reason. They argue that younger, unsophisticated investors are trading more aggressively, often influenced by social media, online personalities, and option speculation. They worry that removing the $25,000 requirement could make it easier for inexperienced traders to take on too much risk. Webull, the St. Petersburg, Florida-based retail broker, which had $564 million in revenue in 2025, says the rule had become outdated. Anthony Denier, the company's U.S. CEO, says retail investors are now, quote, more informed, close quote, and have better tools than they did when the rule was first created, and that the changes better reflect how modern markets work and remove limits that can feel arbitrary. The new system will focus less on how many trades a person makes and more on whether the account actually has enough money to support the risk at any given moment. Brokerages will now be able to monitor accounts in real time and block trades that would create a margin deficit. Firms that don't want to build those systems can instead calculate whether a customer fell short at the end of the day. If a trader does not fix that shortfall within 5 business days, the brokerage can freeze the account from taking on more borrowed money trades for up to 90 days. Small shortfalls under $1,000 or 5% of the account size can be ignored. FINRA said the changes should be easier for customers to understand and cheaper for brokers to enforce. Firms will have 45 days after FINRA publishes its formal notice before the rule takes effect, though brokerages can phase in the changes over the following 18 months. Whether the change ultimately helps retail traders will take years to answer. The next time a meme stock implodes or a wave of small investors blows up on options, critics will almost certainly point back to this decision. One thing is already clear, though. The rule change is good for retail brokers. Shares of Robinhood and Webull were both up more than 10% on Wednesday. Next up, SantaCon organizer arrested in $1 million fraud scheme. Allegedly spent proceeds on fine dining and vacations. The organizer allegedly used participants' fees to pay for a lakefront property, multiple vacations, and expensive meals. By Allison Durkee of the Forbes staff. Stefan Pildes was arrested Wednesday after being indicted on 1 count of wire fraud, which federal prosecutors note can be punishable by up to 20 years in prison. Pildes allegedly spent approximately half of the $2.7 million SantaCon raised from attendees and venue between 2019 and 2024 on personal expenses, with prosecutors alleging the defendant directed the event's funds to his own entity, Creative Opportunity Group. SantaCon is a yearly event in which attendees in various cities dress up in Santa costumes and embark on a bar crawl. And New York City's event has long garnered controversy and widespread criticism from locals for the rowdy and inebriated crowds that gather throughout the city. The event generates revenue from attendees and venues that participate in the bar crawl and bills itself as a quote-unquote charity event, with the indictment noting SantaCon previously claimed in an email that none of its producers receive income from its proceeds. In actuality, prosecutors allege only a quote-unquote small fraction of the money raised was given to charity, while Pildes instead allegedly spent the event's funds on luxury vacations, a lakefront property, and expensive meals. SantaCon NYC has not yet responded to a request for comment. $1.4 million, that's how much Pildes' Creative Opportunity Group received from SantaCon between 2019 and 2024, prosecutors allege, making up more than half the $2.7 million the SantaCon events took in overall. According to the indictment, the SantaCon proceeds that Pildes allegedly spent himself were used to pay for such expenses as renovating a lakefront property in New Jersey, leasing a luxury Manhattan apartment, a $3,000 birthday dinner at a Michelin-starred restaurant, a luxury vehicle, a $100,000 investment at a resort in Cuba, and vacations in Hawaii, Las Vegas, and Vail, Colorado. Pildes has not yet issued a plea in the case, and it's unclear whether he'll ultimately be convicted or sentenced to prison. It also remains to be seen how his arrest could impact SantaCon, which takes place each year in early December. Here are some items from Forbes' daily newsletter. This is by Daniel Kemtab of the Forbes staff. As the Iran war puts pressure on airlines, executives are fueling speculation about industry consolidation. United Airlines CEO Scott Kirby suggested a possible merger with American Airlines to President Donald Trump earlier this year, according to Bloomberg. Meanwhile, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy told CNBC last week he believes there is, quote, room for some mergers in the aviation industry, close quote, and that Trump, quote, loves to see big deals, close quote. Still, Henry Hartvelt, president of travel market research and advisory firm Atmosphere Research Group, tells Forbes that a United American combination remains highly unlikely. Continuing in the newsletter, Amazon is making its most aggressive move yet to close the gap with SpaceX to shortcut its way into becoming a cell service provider. Amazon announced Tuesday an agreement to acquire satellite company Globalstar for $11.57 billion to expand its satellite business as it aims to compete with SpaceX's Starlink business. Globalstar stockholders will receive $90 per share of Amazon common stock in a deal expected to close in 2027 that will enable Amazon Leo, the company's commercial satellite business, to provide direct-to-device cell service to customers without hardware like cell towers or antennas. In addition to the acquisition, Amazon announced it will partner with Apple to continue to support iPhone and Apple Watch models currently using Globalstar's existing and planned upcoming satellite constellations, collaborating on the phone maker's satellite features, including emergency SOS, messages, Find My, and roadside assistance. Amazon is vying to close the gap with SpaceX's Starlink, which has had a significant head start with more than 10,000 satellites in orbit and over 10 million users since launching to customers in 2021. Amazon Leo has sent more than 200 satellites, and its commercial launch is planned for mid-2026. In 2025, Globalstar revenue was up 9% from the previous year at a record $273 million, driven largely by recurring sales to Apple, and posted a net loss of $8.65 million, up from $63.16 million in 2024. Quote, what we're seeing is a setup for the Battle of the Titans between SpaceX and Amazon, close quote, space analyst Chris Quilty told Forbes. Quote, SpaceX was interested in acquiring the same spectrum, and that probably accounts for the premium price that we're seeing being paid, close quote. Globalstar currently has a market cap of around $10 billion and reportedly had early talks with SpaceX, which was interested in purchasing the company's spectrum, the airwaves that provide cell service directly to devices as opposed to through cell towers or antennas. Amazon Leo initially launched in 2019 under the name Project Kuiper, with Bezos recruiting Rajiv Badial, a former SpaceX executive fired by Elon Musk, in 2018 to lead it. Development proceeded slowly for several years due to rocket shortages, manufacturing disruption, and launch failures, despite Amazon investing billions in satellite manufacturing facilities and launch contracts. The program received its operational license from the Federal Communications Commission in July 2020 and achieved its first orbitable milestone in October 2023 with the successful deployment of two prototype satellites. Large-scale deployment began in April 2025, and by November that year, Amazon retired the Project Kuiper codename in favor of Amazon Leo, marking the program's formal transition from a research and development initiative to a commercial enterprise. $10 billion. That's the amount Amazon committed to building Amazon Leo in 2020. The acquisition of Globalstar marks Amazon's biggest bet to scale out its satellite business and is the tech giant's second-largest acquisition to date, falling behind its $13.7 billion acquisition of Whole Foods in 2017. The deal is the latest chapter in what has become one of the defining business rivalries of the 21st century, the billionaire space race. The race's principal actors have been Elon Musk's SpaceX, which seeks to colonize Mars and provide global satellite internet via Starlink, Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin and Amazon's satellite program, and Richard Branson's Virgin Group through Virgin Galactic and the now-canceled Virgin Orbit. Other tech billionaires, including Robinhood founder Baiju Bhatt, former Google head, and current Relativity Space CEO Eric Schmidt, and crypto billionaire Jed McCaleb, have made bets into the space economy in recent years. For most of the past decade, Musk has lapped the field. SpaceX, which dramatically reduced the cost of rocket launches, has completed more than 600 launches of its spacecraft since its first successful launch in 2008, while Blue Origin only achieved its first successful orbital launch in January 2025. The asymmetry has been even more pronounced in the satellite internet battle. SpaceX's Starlink already serves more than 10 million customers across more than 100 countries, while Amazon Leo is set to launch mid-2026. The World Economic Forum estimates the space economy will reach a valuation of over $1.8 trillion by 2035 from more than $600 billion last year. With the primary drive being the commercial sector, including satellites, space tourism, and data centers, that's represented around 80% of the industry in recent years. Live Nation shares fall after jury says it operated monopoly in landmark decision. By Antonio Pequeño IV of the Forbes staff. Live Nation shares tumbled over 6% on Wednesday after a New York jury found it and Ticketmaster operated as a monopoly, marking a win for dozens of states that accused the live entertainment company of violating antitrust laws around ticketing, music venues, and concert promotion, claims Live Nation has denied. The verdict was reached after the 4 days of deliberations in a trial that lasted several weeks, in which Live Nation was accused of overcharging fans for tickets and pressuring venues into using Ticketmaster, one of its subsidiaries. Live Nation shares closed down 6.3% Wednesday, erasing almost 2 weeks' worth of gains. The jury found Ticketmaster overcharged customers by $1.72 per ticket, the New York Times reported. The terms of the incoming settlement will be determined by Judge Aaron Subramanian in a later proceeding. Forbes has reached out to Live Nation for comment. A breakup of Live Nation and Ticketmaster is being sought by some of the states suing the parent company. Live Nation acquired Ticketmaster in an all-stock deal valued at $2.5 billion. Ticketmaster sells around 10 times the number of tickets sold by its closest rival, AEG, the Times reported, citing testimony from the trial. The landmark ruling is another knock against Live Nation, which reached a settlement with the Justice Department just last month, requiring it to pay $280 million in damages, divest from 13 of its amphitheaters, and introduce a cap on ticketing service fees at 15%. Live Nation generated $690.7 million in revenue in 2025, according to its full-year results, which noted the company brought in a record-breaking $25.2 billion that year. Over 30 states rejected the settlement and instead pressed Live Nation in the current trial. New York Attorney General Letitia James said the settlement, quote, fails to address the monopoly at the center of this case and would benefit Live Nation at the expense of consumers, close quote. Up next, RFK Jr. denies saying black children should be reparented, despite recording of June comments. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said Thursday he's unfamiliar with the term, quote-unquote, reparent, and doubts he ever used it during testimony before Congress, despite using the term during a 2024 podcast interview when he said, quote-unquote, every black child needs to be, quote-unquote, reparented. Kennedy said, I don't even know what that phrase means, and I doubt that I said that. I'm not going to answer something I didn't say, Kennedy said when asked by Representative Terry Sewell, Democrat from Alabama, to explain his comments. Kennedy said during a June 2024 episode of the 19 Keys podcast, quote, every black kid is now just standard put on Adderall, on SSRIs, benzos, which are known to induce violence, and those kids are going to have a chance to go somewhere and get reparented, close quote, he said, explaining his proposal for so-called quote-unquote healing farms as an alternative for children on prescription medication. Kennedy also used the term in a July 2024 interview with the Latino Capitalist podcast, describing his quote-unquote wellness farms as a place where people can go to, quote, get off of illegal drugs, off of opiates, but also legal drugs and other psychiatric drugs, and to spend time, as much time as they need, 3 or 4 years if they need it, to learn to get reparented, close quote. Kennedy has repeatedly questioned drugs to aid mental health and weight loss and has repeatedly linked selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, to school shootings, telling Fox News in the wake of a school shooting in Minneapolis last year, quote, we can't exclude those as a culprit, close quote, referring to, quote, SSRI drugs and some of the other psychiatric drugs that might be contributing to violence, close quote. Kennedy also told Elon Musk in a 2023 interview, there is, quote, tremendous circumstantial evidence, close quote, that, quote, SSRIs and benzos and other drugs are doing this, close quote, referring to school shootings. And he told Bill Maher that year, quote, there is no time in American history or human history that kids were going to schools and shooting their classmates. It really started happening coterminous with the introduction of these drugs, with Prozac and the other drugs, close quote. There's no evidence tying school shootings to psychiatric drugs, though some experts have pointed out that school shooters are more likely to have mental health conditions being treated by SSRIs. Kennedy admitted the measles vaccine could have saved the life of an unvaccinated child who died in Texas last year when pressed by Representative Linda Sanchez, Democrat from California. Kennedy said, quote, it's possible, certainly, close quote, when asked if the vaccine could have saved the child's life. Sanchez also criticized Kennedy for ending the CDC's campaign to promote the flu vaccine, telling him, quote, you suspended this pro-vaccine messaging campaign, but somehow you're spending taxpayer dollars to drink milk, shirtless in a hot tub with Kid Rock, close quote, referring to a video Kennedy posted of him and Kid Rock working out and urging Americans to, quote, get active and eat real food, close quote. Thursday's hearing was among a series of appearances Kennedy and other agency heads will make on Capitol Hill this week to discuss Trump's fiscal year 2027 budget request, which includes a proposed 13% cut, about $16 billion, to health and human services spending. The budget builds on Kennedy's Make America Health Again initiative by establishing the, quote, Administration for a Healthy America, AHA, as part of a major reorganization of the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, to prioritize programs that improve nutrition, food and drug quality and safety standards and prevent chronic disease, close quote, according to the proposal. Among the HHS cuts, the National Institutes of Health faces a $5 billion reduction. The Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, which helps low-income Americans with their energy bills, would be eliminated completely, as would Community Services Block Grants, which the Trump administration claims are a, quote, duplicative slush fund for woke community action agencies, close quote. Continuing in Forbes, the new trust metric in crypto, Verifiable Reserves Over Trade Volume, by Sean Lee. Total centralized exchange trading volume experienced a sharp contraction in the first quarter of 2026. Market activity fell by roughly 48% from its October 2025 peak and settled at $4.3 trillion by March. The speculative momentum that defined the prior year faded. It gave way to a more measured and cautious trading environment. Volatility rose as macroeconomic forces took control of market direction and broke historical seasonal patterns. Forced deleveraging events also presented significant challenges. They wiped out billions in peripheral open interest and prompted a massive reallocation of risk. That scenario highlighted a long-known crypto market structure vulnerability even the International Monetary Fund warned participants about. This is the rapid expansion of the cryptocurrency ecosystem, which, according to the IMF, poses substantial operational and financial integrity challenges when left unchecked. Sudden market contractions cap expose severe vulnerabilities when centralized entities operate with poor risk management or disclosure. This often leads to frozen withdrawals and systemic contagion across trading venues. Because of these underlying risks, the historical practice of measuring platform health through trading volume is increasingly viewed as relying on easily manipulated noise. The new definitive signal of institutional and retail trust is asset concentration and capital retention. As the broader market cooled and speculative narratives exhausted themselves faster than before, capital did not flee the ecosystem. It consolidated upward into venues offering execution certainty. Traders and institutions moved their funds to platforms capable of proving their financial safety through transparent, verifiable frameworks. Structurally, market activity remained heavily concentrated in the derivatives market, which maintained a 9.6 times ratio over spot trading throughout the quarter. Trading volume is no longer viewed as a sufficient standalone indicator of platform strength, as it does not fully capture underlying capital stability. Wash trading and incentive programs can temporarily inflate execution numbers, but they cannot fake deposits. User asset reserves now serve as an undeniable, clear signal of market confidence. Yet blockchain security firms emphasize that true transparency requires assessing both sides of the balance sheet. According to auditing standards developed by cybersecurity firms like Hacken, a comprehensive proof of reserve system must incorporate cryptographic proof alongside regular independent assessments. According to Hacken, this verification often involves data structures like Merkle trees, which allow users to independently confirm their account balances are included in the total liability calculations without exposing private data. These technical safeguards prevent platforms from underreporting liabilities to appear fully solvent. Binance presents the clearest case study for this structural shift toward verifiable cryptography. According to recent CoinGlass data, the exchange saw its user asset reserves reach $152.9 billion in the first quarter. This represents a massive 73.5% share of all major centralized exchange assets combined, holding 9.6 times the reserves of OKX, its closest competitor. Quote, "When markets become uncertain, users make decisions based on trust. The fact that $152.9 billion in assets remain on Binance reflects something we've built deliberately over years. Transparency in our reserves, consistency in our protections, and a commitment to putting user security above everything else," close quote, noted Binance co-CEO Richard Teng. According to Teng, this concentration of capital validates a consistency in protections and a commitment to prioritizing user security. Capital gravitates towards certainty. This dominant share of reserves is a direct reflection of verifiable platform safety rather than a marketing achievement. Holding $152.9 billion requires architecture built on transparent oversight rather than corporate promises. Trust in digital asset custody is now proven through strict safeguarding standards. As $83 billion of BTC is held by public companies, institutional investors increasingly demand bank-grade custody frameworks to mitigate the risks associated with centralized platforms. Corporate treasuries cannot afford to park capital on venues lacking clear regulatory compliance or dedicated risk controls. Global standard-setting bodies are actively formalizing these exact requirements to prevent future market disruptions. The Basel Committee on Banking Supervision already established prudential guidelines, emphasizing that entities managing digital asset exposures must maintain strict asset segregation and loss-absorbing capital buffers. Historical failures in the exchange sector often stemmed from commingled customer funds and a lack of independent audits. Regular proof of reserves fundamentally eliminates this uncertainty of traditional financial reporting. It replaces opaque accounting with clear evidence that users can verify independently. Institutional capital requires strict asset segregation, ensuring that client funds are never mixed with corporate holdings or used to cover operational shortfalls. Such frameworks allow an exchange to mathematically prove it holds client funds on a one-to-one basis. On-chain wallet transparency creates a continuous publicly accessible audit trail that operates around the clock. Building on this need for continuous oversight, decentralized infrastructure provider Chainlink argues that traditional quarterly snapshot audits are inadequate for always-on digital markets. They advocate for real-time cryptographic verification to prevent the sudden reserve drifting that characterized past market collapses. With this infrastructure, retail and institutional actors can monitor the safety of their parked capital continuously. Global regulatory licenses, capital buffers, and stringent compliance checks further reinforce these measures. This means that financial safety is no longer an empty guarantee, but a verifiable reality where capital naturally flows toward platforms that provide this level of oversight. This effectively turns transparent custody into the primary driver of market share retention over the long term. This massive concentration of secure assets acts as a liquidity flywheel for both spot and derivative markets. Perpetual futures now define market activity, generating $3.5 trillion in monthly volume. Despite the broader market cooldown, activity concentrated upward as Binance maintained a dominant market share across all major trading venues. Order book depth provides a direct window into this execution capability. In the Bitcoin futures market, Binance maintained an average plus or minus 1% two-sided depth of approximately $284 million during the first quarter. This dwarfed the $160 million depth on OKX and the $76.55 million available on Bybit. Binance also captured roughly 32% of the spot market overall, according to CryptoQuant. Its specific spot share actually increased under pressure, rising from 34.0% in January to 35.4% in March. While secondary exchanges like MEXC and Gate gained some traction in spot volume, the competitive field remains highly fragmented below the top tier. Quote, as trading activity normalized in the first quarter, market structure became clearer. Derivatives continued to lead price discovery, while liquidity consolidated on platforms able to support scale. In a lower volume environment, Binance's consistent leadership across both spot and perpetual markets reflects the value users place on deep liquidity and reliable execution, close quote, noted Ting. None of these secondary platforms individually approach the scale required by large-cap traders. The derivatives market tells a similar story of capital consolidation. Binance captured 40% of perpetual futures and processed $1.4 trillion in monthly volume. Cumulative volume in 2026 reinforces this trend. The exchange achieved nearly $1 trillion in spot volume and $4.5 trillion in perpetual futures. These figures are the natural result of capital parking where technical execution and deep liquidity intersect safely. Traders require thick order books to execute large positions without market impact costs. That critical depth only exists where underlying capital is secure enough to attract major liquidity providers. The cryptocurrency industry has officially transitioned away from volume-based vanity metrics toward the hard reality of asset concentration and verifiable asset custody. The market cooldown in first quarter of 2026 didn't signal a loss of interest among institutional or retail participants. Instead, it represented a clear flight to quality and technical security. New liquidity funnels like ETF and digital asset treasury companies demand regulated deep infrastructure. These entities act as walled gardens that direct capital exclusively into the most trusted layers of the market. To support these massive capital inflows, regulators and industry watchdogs now recognize that high insurance ratios and verifiable reserves are critical components for preventing systemic market failures. In fact, the European Insurance and Occupational Pensions Authority, EIOPA, technical advice recommends a one-to-one capital requirement to all EU crypto holdings. The EIOPA based its recommendation on empirical analyses showing that existing capital weight options, such as the 80% stress level applied to intangible assets, underestimate the real risks of crypto exposures. This makes a full 100% haircut the more prudent standard, which the regulator expects to promote the harmonized and proportionate treatment of cryptocurrencies. Investors are now prioritizing capital preservation and execution, certainly over speculative, thinly traded venues. As macroeconomic conditions fluctuate across cycles, platforms that can transparently prove their solvency will continue to absorb the majority of global trading capital. The future's financial safety will be written exclusively by platforms that successfully merge deep, liquid markets with the transparent, verifiable custody of digital assets. Moving now to Barron's, more disabled Americans can open ABLE accounts. Now they can save worry-free. More Americans with disabilities can now use a key tax-advantaged account without affecting their eligibility for government assistance. Starting this year, individuals can open ABLE accounts if the onset of their disability occurred before age 46, up from age 26 previously. That means an estimated 6 million more Americans with disabilities or their families can use these accounts to manage their day-to-day cash flow or save for future needs without losing federal disability benefits. Quote, "It's the difference between keeping their Medicaid benefits but still being able to save and plan for the future," close quote, said Mary Morris, CEO of Commonwealth Savers, which oversees Virginia's ABLE program. Quote, "So that's a tremendous advantage," close quote. Established in 2014, ABLE accounts allow individuals with disabilities to save up to $100,000 without that money affecting their eligibility for federal need-based benefits. Earnings in the accounts aren't taxed if used on qualified disability expenses, which encompass a broad range of quality of life costs. But the major advantage of ABLE accounts is that much of the money isn't counted toward Medicaid or Supplemental Security Income, SSI, eligibility requirements. Generally, individuals cannot have more than $2,000 in their name at the end of the month, including what's in a regular checking or savings account, to qualify for their full Medicaid or SSI benefits. The limits can become a problem if individuals don't spend down their entire benefits every month and those funds accumulate in a regular checking or savings account and surpass the $2,000 resource limit. Or individuals can risk their eligibility if they deposit some earned income into a non-ABLE account and exceed that monthly limit. That is what happened to Tricia Rosen's 24-year-old son, who is neurodiverse, when he held a seasonable job at a retail store last fall. Because of a payroll issue, what he earned was deposited in his regular checking account rather than his ABLE account. That was enough to hit his monthly benefits. Quote, "His SSI benefit got reduced from over $900 down to like $200, close quote, said Rosen, a certified financial planner in Newberry, Massachusetts, who typically uses an ABLE account for her son to avoid situations like that one. Quote, "It's 1,000 times easier to manage his money," close quote, "with an ABLE account," she said. Many ABLE accounts also come with a debit card, allowing individuals to pay for everyday expenses without having to always move money from the ABLE account into a checking account. Quote, "It allows for independence while still allowing them to have some benefits," close quote, said Natalie Pine, a certified financial planner in College Station, Texas, who focuses on individuals with disabilities and their families. ABLE accounts are also a quote-unquote game changer for an unforeseen windfall, said Michael Davis, a certified financial planner in Greensboro, North Carolina. Quote, "An insurance claim comes through, an unexpected inheritance lands, a well-meaning aunt sends a generous birthday check," close quote, Davis said. Quote, "With an ABLE account, they have a safe place to park those funds without losing benefits," close quote. ABLE accounts can also serve as investment accounts to save up for expected needs down the line. That works well for those who don't rely on federal benefits and don't need to worry about their accounts exceeding the $100,000 threshold, above which assets in ABLE accounts count toward the benefit limit. To be eligible for an ABLE account, you must be already receiving SSI or Social Security disability benefits or submit a disability certification from a physician. Quote, "It's physical disabilities, learning and developmental disabilities, neurological conditions. Mental health illnesses can be a qualifying disability, so it's really quite broad," close quote, Morris said. Raising the disability age is a big deal. Quote, "We advocated for years to increase that age onset, recognizing that not all disabilities present or start or are apparent before age 26, close quote, Morris said. Quote, "A lot of neurological disabilities present later. Workforce accidents present later," close quote. Under the change, about 1.2 million more military veterans are now eligible to open an ABLE account, according to the ABLE National Resource Center, plus many first responders, Morris said. adults with disabilities who are diagnosed later in life, and those disabled in car crashes or other accidents now qualify. Quote, what the ABLE has done is displaced the need for a smaller first-party special needs trust, close quote, Pine said, describing the workaround some of her clients previously used. Quote, it's easier to set up, you don't need an attorney, and it's still subject to the same kind of rules, close quote. Multiple people may contribute to the person's ABLE account up to the $19,000 annual limit. Qualified disability expenses include education, housing, transportation, employment, training and support, healthcare, financial management, and legal fees. States sponsor ABLE accounts. So far, 47 states and the District of Columbia have active programs. You can also sign up for an account offered by the 29 states that permit non-residents to register. But you should consider any tax benefits your state may offer on ABLE contributions. Additionally, the Federal Savers Credit can apply to ABLE contributions made by the account beneficiary. Morris expects the expanded ABLE eligibility will help, quote, grow the programs faster and ultimately provide better and less expensive programs to everybody, close quote. Moving on to Fortune magazine, the $20,000 longevity weekend for those who recognize that more time is the ultimate luxury, by Jesselyn Tropp. On my first day at Canyon Ranch's $20,000 four-day longevity 8 retreat in November, the schedule sounded dauntingly packed. I received a list of appointments with doctors and wellness specialists across a range of fields, from fitness to flexibility, meditation to mental health. In between electrocardiograms, carotid ultrasounds, and DEXA scans, I would attend spa appointments, fitness classes, and group hikes through the Santa Catalina Mountains, hobnob with the resort's high-powered guests over dinner and at the pool, and explore the latest tools for neuro and muscle stimulation to reduce stress and reverse the signs of aging at the Center for Life Enhancement. By day two, I was a believer. It helped that a torturous treadmill test yielded an explanation for a host of seemingly disparate health problems that had long stumped my regular doctors. This is how I found out that I, a reasonably healthy 42-year-old who couldn't understand why tennis teammates nearly twice my age ran circles around me on the court, had been afflicted by long COVID. Then on the third day, a physical therapist eliminated years of persistent neck pain with a quick realignment of my pelvis. For many high-end travelers, a $20,000 vacation could mean a private jet to a remote tropical island or a luxury villa suspended over a glistening turquoise ocean. 4 days in the Arizona desert, in my case, furnished by the ranch to showcase the program, might not sound worthy of a five-figure price tag, but the cost starts to look quite different when you consider it a down payment on your long-term health. Longevity has become big business in the U.S. and worldwide. Human life expectancy has increased by nearly three decades over the past century, but for many, the focus has switched to quote-unquote health span, defined as the portion of our lives when we are free from serious disease. On average, we have 9 years of life left once our good health runs out, according to a 2021 Mayo Clinic study. Now, a health and wellness sector driven by advances in biotechnology, AI, and preventive health is testing the outer limits of what we can do to live longer, healthier lives. The longevity industry, as it has come to be known, is expected to reach $8 trillion by 2030, according to UBS. Players run the gamut from clinics and quick-fix med spas to products and supplements intended to slow the ravages of age. The sector has produced new celebrities such as biohacker Brian Johnson, who sells supplements under the brand name Blueprint with the tagline, Don't Die, and veterans of the self-help world such as motivational speaker Tony Robbins are getting in on the game too. Robbins opened a chain of longevity-themed clinics, Fountain Life, and is expanding the concept with the 2026 debut of The Estate, a group of luxury longevity resorts and residences. The first location is slated to open in Los Angeles' Century City at $35 for an annual membership. Canyon Ranch, the holistic wellness resort founded in 1979, launched Longevity 8 at its flagship location in Tucson in 2024, naming the program for the eight principles it espouses: integrative medicine, flexibility and fitness, nutrition, sleep, spiritual wellness, mental and emotional health, outdoor activity, and strength and endurance. It's the brainchild of CEO Mark Rivers, who, facing his 60th birthday, wondered how he could extend not just his lifespan, but his health span. Over 18 one-on-one consultations, clinicians measure more than 250 crucial biomarkers. Canyon Ranch's program is distinctive, but a few other immersive, longevity-focused Lux getaways can be found around the world. Six Senses Ibiza, Europe's Lanzerhof Resorts, and Three Forks Ranch in Colorado offer genetic testing, disease screening, and cutting-edge treatment alongside lavish spa pampering. The Four Seasons Hotel in Singapore houses Qi Longevity, Asia's first such clinic. Its flagship program starts at $14,000 and includes consultations and sessions with a dietitian and a psychologist, as well as a host of medical, physical, and cognitive tests. It's the newest version of the health spa vacation, a tradition that has been popular among those who could afford it for thousands of years, from ancient Greeks crossing the Mediterranean to Epidaurus and Indians climbing the Himalayas for yogic healing, to medieval British travelers flocking to the curative mineral waters of Bath and 19th century European sojourners seeking high-altitude health retreats in the Swiss Alps. Canyon Ranch's approach has taken off among entrepreneurs on the cusp of burnout. Quote, I've learned in 34 years of working here that Canyon Ranch tends to attract a type AAA personality, close quote. Mike Siemens, the property's ridiculously fit director of performance science, told my cohort, quote, that can be great for the business world, but all or nothing perfection is lousy when it comes to exercise, close quote. Together, we 11, a mother and daughters trio who own an adventurous travel company for women, a longtime married couple, and six solo participants, myself included, took a journey into the unknown, sharing exquisite but abstemious meals, sweat sessions, and anxieties. We bonded over the constant screeches emanating from our smartphones, which, courtesy of the stockpile of Bluetooth-enabled devices we were given each day, measured everything from our sleep quality to our sugar intake. Quote, I probably did more for my health in any single day here than I have in 2.5 years, close quote, Jack Kramer, an attorney from Indiana, shared at our group's closing circle. Quote, I have hope now. There's a tiger in me that just wants to take the world by the horns, and I feel like that guy again, close quote. At the end of the program, we were each presented with a personalized binder that neatly organized the reams of medical data and test results we had generated. We were also each assigned a personal board of directors, including all the experts we had seen, from nutritionists to physicians to mental health providers. After participants leave, that board gathers at a conference table to pore over each binder of medical results and quote what you've shared with us in terms of your intentions, goals, and challenges, close quote. Dr. Stephen Brewer, medical director at Canyon Ranch Tucson, explained, calling it an, quote, amazing moment, close quote. Long after they fly home, participants continue to receive advice and insights. But the most important takeaway of the program is a mindset, Siemens said. Quote, if you take home only one thing, make it this, close quote, he told us, quote, stay in the game, don't be a perfectionist, close quote. Next up in Fortune, the Great Software Panic. AI will change software as it exists today, but history shows the biggest changes may not be what anyone expects. This is by Jeremy Kahn. On February 2nd, Anthropic announced a new feature for its Claude Cowork AI software, a simple plug-in to help users perform legal tasks such as reviewing contracts or crafting non-disclosure agreements. At first glance, the news hardly seemed earth-shattering, but it shook financial markets to their foundations. Investors wiped $285 billion off the market value of tech stocks in the 24 hours after the tool debuted, with software vendors particularly hard hit. Over the following weeks, the rout continued and even inspired a new term, quote, the SaaSpocalypse, close quote, which refers to the software as a service business model common to business software vendors today. Software stocks have recovered some of their losses, but at press time were about 8% below levels at the end of January. To many investors, the logic is simple. AI models, such as Anthropic's Claude, will eliminate the need for specialized business software. Companies will just ask AI to perform the tasks currently handled by other vendors' software, or they will ask AI coding agents from Anthropic, OpenAI, or Google to quote-unquote vibe code bespoke software tailored to their needs. Either way, businesses will no longer need to buy expensive software from traditional vendors like Salesforce, ServiceNow, and Microsoft, or from the hundreds of smaller niche firms offering legal tech, procurement systems, or financial planning software. The doomsday view has sparked a heated debate, with critics insisting the sell-off is overdone. Bank of America senior analyst Vivek Arya called investors souring on SaaS business, quote-unquote, indiscriminate, overblown, and logically inconsistent. Even as big an AI booster as NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang told CNBC that, quote, the market's got it wrong, close quote. Rather than ending the need for pre-built software, AI agents will use the software to accomplish tasks, he argued. While the advent of AI is certainly a new development for investors to wrap their heads around, the fundamental question at the heart of the SaaS spocalypse debate is as old as innovation itself. Each new piece of technology opens new possibilities and leads to existing practices being reassessed. The factors that cause one innovation to supplant its predecessor while another technology evolves alongside an incumbent or follows a different path entirely can vary and are hard to predict, according to experts in history and economic theory whom Fortune spoke to. In many cases, the expected outcomes, both the overly optimistic as well as the gloom-ridden, turn out to be widely off the mark. Take video cameras, which came on the scene in the 1980s. Some predicted a proliferation of filmmaking because video lowered production costs and the need for specialized knowledge, and there was an explosion of visual content. The total number of film titles released in the 1990s was double the figure for the 1970s, according to data from IMDb. But video, for the most part, barely impacted the production of box office hits, which continued to be shot on film. The average cost of feature film production, rather than falling, tripled in constant dollars between 1980 and 2007, according to data from the Motion Picture Association of America. What actually happened is that video and film occupied almost completely different market niches. People turned to video for non-theatrical content, like educational and training films, but still looked to film and professional production for major studio releases. Around the same time that neophyte directors were discovering video cameras, desktop publishing was also gaining traction, and leading to dire predictions of the death of commercial print shops. After all, companies could now do their own pre-press design and layout work, and businesses could print their own documents using compact and ubiquitous color laser printers. There would be no need to hire a commercial printer. And yet desktop publishing didn't kill commercial printing. Instead, in the decade after the tech debuted, the number of people employed in printing and related support activities in the U.S. actually climbed, peaking at about 680,000 workers in 1998, while the number of commercial print shops rose to an all-time high of 62,000 in 1995, according to U.S. government statistics. Desktop publishing actually allowed more people to set up print shops. What it did eliminate was the need for specialized pre-press roles like typesetters, paste-up artists, and color separation specialists. Those specific jobs did see marked declines throughout the 1990s. Meanwhile, the expanding number of print shops led to increased competition and declining margins. This eventually led to industry consolidation, as the only way to make any profit was through economies of scale. Could something similar happen with software as AI lowers the barriers to writing code? Rather than killing off software vendors, it may be that many more companies will be formed to write specialized business applications because it will be less important to hire scarce specialized coding talent. And similar to printing, SaaS profit margins may shrink, forcing consolidation. But that won't happen because AI ate SaaS. It will happen because AI fed SaaS. Lauren Zeckert, an economist at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, says history over most of the past century has shown that firms have become even more specialized and outsourced more ancillary functions. He does not see AI reversing this trend. Quote, I think we will increasingly see niche software being used and produced. But if we ask, quote, who's going to make that software, close quote, it seems like it could still be the same firms, he says. Why? Because software vendors already have all the processes and infrastructure set up to make and maintain software, the security protocols, the code reviews, etc. Companies outside the software business would have to reinvent these processes. And while AI might be able to automate some of that, there's still a high probability non-software companies would mess this up. The economic theory that determines why a company decides to buy something rather than build it was pioneered by British economist Ronald Coase beginning in the late 1930s. Coase's idea was that buy versus build decisions were largely determined by exchange costs, or how easy it was to specify and enforce contractual terms for what the firm needed. For commoditized production inputs, exchange costs tend to be low, and so businesses tend to buy those things. For highly bespoke ones, or when the firm's requirements are likely to change rapidly, suitable contracts are difficult to make it at a reasonable cost, and so businesses tend to produce those inputs internally. Businesses also have to weigh the risk that a supplier will take advantage of them, using leverage to exact higher payments over time, against concerns that building the capability in-house can be done at the right quality, quantity, cost, and time frame. In the case of AI and software, it is possible that companies will allow employees to vibe code small artisanal productivity tools that make their jobs easier. But for critical but somewhat commoditized systems where specialization is of limited competitive advantage, companies may find it more efficient to continue buying from established vendors. Such vendors can afford to employ the best coders and UX designers, and they have established processes for delivering product roadmaps and maintaining large code bases. In that scenario, the software market may bifurcate, with the most successful existing vendors continuing to thrive, while more niche application makers find themselves increasingly competing against in-house vibe-coded solutions. Oliver Hart, a Nobel Prize-winning Harvard University economist who researches the economic theory of the firm, says there are several exchange cost considerations in AI and software. On the one hand, AI ought to lower the cost for existing software vendors to customize their products for specific customers, making it less likely that companies will choose to build their own software. However, Hart says, to the extent that software vendors profit in part by locking in their customers' data or by charging fees to move data off their platforms, those exchange costs may compel some companies to take over software developments in order to gain more flexibility and control over future costs. The conclusion to the AI versus SaaS battle may also play out more slowly than many people expect. Companies almost always adopt any new technology gradually in order to minimize risks, and they are unlikely to switch wholesale from buying SaaS products to writing their own code, says James Cortada, a professor at the University of Minnesota who specializes in the history of information technology and who worked for years at IBM. It has taken 4 decades for companies to switch from programming mainframes and COBOL to more modern program languages such as C++ and Java, Cortada says. And it took most of a decade for businesses to migrate from using on-site servers to the cloud, and even then many companies continued to keep their most vital data in servers they directly controlled. Cortada thinks it's far more likely that existing vendors will increasingly integrate AI into their software. Quote, asking people to use AI to code something critical, like a payroll system or a procurement system, is like asking people to change flat tires on a car that continues to drive at 60 miles an hour, close quote, Cortada says. Quote, it's too risky, close quote. You've been listening to Down to Business. My name's Greg Conroy. This has been brought to you by the folks at Mind's Eye Organization, helping the low vision and blind communities in the St. Louis region since 1973. Have a great week. Take care.